Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everybody. Today on the show, we have Rachel Holt and Elizabeth Humble. They are sisters who were raised in an independent fundamentalist Baptist church they've now identified as a cult, Cornerstone Baptist Church in Colorado Springs, Colorado. In 1998, Rachel was the whistleblower instrumental in the eventual arrest and criminal conviction of Charles Dean Miller, the son of a pastor who would become known to be a decades-long serial pedophile. After law enforcement investigations were corroborated by multiple generations and dozens of victims, his sexual abuse of underage girls was discovered. Liz and Rachel's forthcoming memoir, tentatively titled The King James Virgin and Other Myths of the IFB, tells this story. Rachel currently resides in Southern California, where she works as an educator in the field of biomechanics through the modalities of dance and Pilates. Her extraordinary experiences growing up in an oppressively restrictive environment that harshly policed the female body inform her teaching philosophy through a lens of empathy and inclusion of all bodies. Elizabeth currently lives in Oklahoma near her three daughters and two granddaughters, where she works as a barber, a seamstress, and a food truck owner. That's a hard job. That's a lot of work. She also sits on the board of the Stillwater Downtown Association. Elizabeth attended Nazarene Bible College and later obtained a business management degree following her barber schooling at New Mexico Junior College. Here are Elizabeth and Rachel now. I am so happy to have Rachel and Liz with me today. It's so nice to be able to meet you, and I can't wait for our conversation. And so let's get cooking, where I want to start with you, other Rachel. If you can take a few moments to introduce yourself, and then we'll move on to Liz. Go for it.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm so excited to be here also. It's been a long journey. My name is Rachel Holt, as opposed to Rachel Bernstein, which is going to be an ongoing thing. I currently am in San Diego, California. I teach dance and Pilates, and I am a IFB cult survivor. I am also a co-author of a book that my sister and I, Elizabeth, whom you'll soon meet, wrote about our experience growing up in that. And I'm really excited to talk to Rachel Bernstein about this and to just go with her through this journey of what that looks like for you as the listener.
Oh, it's so nice. And also, do you have a working title for the book yet or no?
We do. The King James Virgins.
That is so good. That's so good. You know what happens when you come up with a great, really catchy title? There are going to be a lot of people out there going, oh, why didn't I think of that? Right. That's a good one.
It's as though it was there all the time. And then I also think about it as being timeless. Right.
Oh, that's good. Right. That's right. And Liz, do you want me to call you Liz or Elizabeth?
Yeah, Liz is great.
Okay, cool. All right. So take a few moments and introduce yourself.
Okay. I am Liz, or Elizabeth Humble. I go by Liz. I currently own a couple of businesses, a food truck, a barbering business, alteration shop. I just work a lot, as well as working on, like what Rachel said, the book and we have a podcast we work on every week. So we grew up in IFB in the same one until around the age, I was about 21 when we finally got out. So I've been out for about 25 years. So we are living life outside of that now, which is amazing. But there has been, you know, a lot of hurdles in life to get over and to deal with and in all aspects of life, including, you know, when you're raised in something, not knowing how to raise your own children, things like that. Both of us have our kids grown. So interesting life after the cult and also inside of it.
So Liz, you mentioned in your intro something about a podcast. So tell us about it.
We call it Sisters Declassified Life Survival Guide. So it's kind of a take on a show our kids watched growing up, but it's two sisters with four daughters dishing drama, trauma, and survival tips for the everyday. It's kind of a long name, but it kind of fit. And we basically talk about, we do like a how-to every week. It's every bi-week, so every other week. But we do a how-to, and then we do a define this. And so we kind of do different things. And we incorporate the cult. We incorporate, you know, raising children. It's basically like listening in on a conversation with me and my sister. So talking about random things, but also, you know, just how to live every day, because there's so many challenges we face all the time.
Right. Right. So I'm making a note to come back to this idea of raising kids and, you know, being raised in a different tradition that's going to have very different views on child rearing, child development. Actually, usually there are no views on child development, but there is a lot about
what is that?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. There's just a lot of rules that are not connected to what is natural to expect at each stage of development, and also without a sensitivity about not only what's possible, but what's healthy. It's totally devoid of all of those things. So I just want to make sure to get into that just as you became moms yourself. And I know, Rachel, you were going to mention something as Liz was talking about the podcast.
Oh, I was just going to expand on the podcast. That it really came out of an idea that we want it, the whole reason for basically 25 years out, coming out and doing something like this. I will reiterate the fact that it took us about 25 years to really be able to go to this place where we're able to talk about it and to write about it and to work through all of the things, because our podcast, if we would have started this 20 years ago, and we would have recorded our phone conversations between the two of us as we co-raise daughters. And we call them roommates 1 through 4. So Liz has 3 and I have 1. So mine's the youngest. Liz's first was the eldest. So it's roommate 1 through 4. We call them our roommates because we don't want to use their names all the time and, you know, deluge them in this therapeutic experiment that we have going on. But the whole reason that we started that, the reason we wrote the book, the reason that we're here today with you and that podcast is a thing, is because we know we're not the only ones, and that the experience that we had with raising daughters and going out of this, you know, world viewpoint, which actually we had no idea what was out there. We had no idea how to do it or how to raise our kids, but we had each other. And that was a really, really critical thing. Whereas had we been solo siblings, it would have been a very different thing. But also the interest or the idea that we had is, okay, well, had we recorded our phone conversations 20 years ago, we would have had a book, we would have had a feature film, we would have had spinoffs, we would have had a TV series. It would have been a whole thing, because our phone conversations are just real. They're what's going on in our life right now and how we're dealing with it. And how we manage to deal with the life that we had, the life that we left, and then the life that we're now living, and trying to hurdle all of these monumental tasks at the moment, but then how we dealt with them, and we talked through them as sisters and as both cult survivors, but then also as females, mothers, women, wife. Liz is a wife, and right, dealing with all that. So it's a, you know, cacophony of everything that we are and who we want to be. And then also the dirty, nitty gritty nuts and bolts of getting through these things on a daily basis. And that was the point, is to sort of be, you know, an inspiration. I mean, people are going to dip in and just listen to it out of pure voyeurism. But that was the goal, is to try and reach out to those who also have gone through this, or it could be a similar experience. It could be another trauma, something else.
Right. So I think about also when I started my podcast, it suddenly dawned on me. And I mean, podcasting became more of a thing around that time anyway. And so, but I think at the time that I was thinking about the podcast, I was thinking I've been already doing this for whatever, 25 years or so. And that means that I've heard many stories up until that point, many, many, many. And I had had that thought over and over of someone else should be learning from this. Like, this shouldn't just be something that people are sharing with me in my office. I mean, even though that is the point of therapy and I'm going to help them, but still, these points are really important, I think, for the public to know. And also for people's healing, sometimes just coming forward with their story and putting it into words, feeling brave to tell it, not feeling like they have to keep the secrets of the place anymore or the secrets of a perpetrator anymore. Because they don't deserve that, right? I think it was sort of a win-win, like the public got educated and people also were able to feel empowered by being able to talk. You mentioned that it took a long time to start putting the thoughts together for a book or thinking about a book. And I'm curious, before we even get into your story, just about that delay. And also, I just want to add this caveat, which is that not everyone needs to tell their story. It's okay. And some people have contacted me almost apologetically, like, I'm just don't think I'll ever be ready. It isn't something you have to do. It's only really if you feel like you want to.
I like that point a lot. It's actually what drove us to this, or at least myself, and Liz can speak for herself also. For years, everyone's told us, you need to write a book. You need to write a book, right? When they hear our stories. And one of the probably smartest people I know said that you can't write until you have to. And for Liz and I both, because our daughters are relatively close in age, so we were both sort of empty nesters around the same time. And it was as though we had a task, we had it done, and then we could move on. And then I would say a lot of this has to do with like political climate. It felt compelling. We had to, if that makes sense. You can't write until you have to. I never felt like I had to until when we started writing the book. And I think Liz had the same experience, but I'll let her speak for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm really glad, though, that you mentioned that. Yes, because people have said to me, and this happened actually in the support group I was running last night, where people, you know, say, I feel bad that I haven't come forward, or I'm not even ready to talk, even in this group. Like, I've come and I want to listen, but I'm not ready to even speak it or say the word cult, or, you know, everyone's at a different point. And what is monumental for one person is just maybe that they have left and stayed out, or that they've told one friend, you know, and that is sufficient, because that was a big deal. And you can put a period at the end of that, unless you start to get that drive and the have-tos. Yeah, it's interesting. Right. Okay. And so, Liz, from your perspective, what was that about for you, about the delay and putting pen to paper, so to speak?
I think exactly pretty much what my sister said as far as raising the children. We lived very close to each other for about 3 years in Southern California, and we would get together almost every day and we would talk about it. And we were like, we need to do this. We need to do this. But there was always, and I don't want to say that our kids were the reason we didn't, but that was more important at the time to just try and do that. Because I don't think, honestly, I could have mentally handled writing the book, because it was extremely therapeutic for me. I haven't had traditional therapy like Rachel has. And so for me, writing it was the first time I had actually wrote a lot of that stuff down and put it out there. So as soon as I wrote it down, it was very therapeutic. But I think if I would have tried to do that while I was raising my kids, it would have been traumatic. And I don't feel like I'm done raising my kids. They're grown and out of the house, but they're still, you know, still need mom. But it's a whole different story when you're not there with them on the daily, you know, and you have more time and headspace to focus on that and even concentrate on what you want to actually put on paper. So,
right. And I think that's really beautifully said, though, about being able to check in with yourself and think, is this the right time? Is this going to just fragment me? Is this going to be too much and I'm not going to be able to be present? I mean, so much of what happens when people, and that's why I want to hear more about your own story early on, when people are raised in these environments, they do get the feeling from their families, often from the community, often that they don't matter as much as the church, as much as God, as much as other things or something standing between you. I think how healing for you to know that you could put your kids first, that this, the church, all of it was not going to stand in between you, which I think is really powerful, actually, and spot on. Okay, so let's talk about first with your parents getting involved and how far back it goes. Did it start with your folks or before them?
My dad and mom were in the Marines, and they found an independent fundamental Baptist church when she was in boot camp where they met. So at their first station, they met, found a church. My dad got himself into some trouble, went to prison, and my mom was in Colorado. Like they had moved around a bunch, but ended up in Colorado. I was 2, Rachel was about 1, because we're only a year apart. So someone came and knocked on her door and invited her to this church. And she said that she felt like she needed to go, and this was the place that God wanted her to be at. So she went. So that's literally all we knew. From the time I was 2, so I was in the nursery at the time, you know, up until I got married and then my husband and I eventually left. Rachel was a baby, so same thing in the nursery. So it was my mom, but she has no, like her parents were totally different. So my dad and mom got divorced when I was 5. He had got out of prison for one thing, and then he was back in prison, and then they got divorced. He was in and out. He was kind of a mess, but my mom stayed with it. She felt a lot of support from them in the younger years. So she felt like it was a place, a safe space. She actually believed that. And I think in the beginning, it probably was a good support system for her, raising 3 kids on her own, basically.
Wow. Incredible. Okay. That's a lot. From that history too, you can see, you know, that both your parents were in what I would see as restrictive environments, you know, with boot camp, with prison, which some people have likened to being like prison, or prison being like boot camp. It's interesting. And so being told what to do, you know, having something highly, highly structured where you don't have a say, you can't ask questions. It's interesting. Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Rachel. You want to add to that?
So I'll bring into that because it is psychology. It is the cult. It is what we're dealing with in terms of a lot of things right now. And this is another reason why Liz and I both felt we had to speak now, is because we've seen this before. We know this pattern. It's not rocket science. So my mother left her restrictive parents and that environment to go to a more restrictive environment, which she felt safe in. My father was abused horribly as a child and then also found the same thing, right? But they again repeat the pattern of abuse. My mother has never felt safe without that structure, without someone having that control over her life where she didn't have to make decisions. And that's almost like a developmental retardation. And I use that in the exact word or meaning that it's meant to be, is that you don't have the skills or the toolkit to actually make decisions on your own. Therefore, you're going to let, right? There's a permission structure there, allowing someone to take over. And I think that that was part of it, where my mom was so overwhelmed with 3 kids by herself as a single parent, that made sense for her to have the structure, to have, you know, a surrounding community that helped her make the decisions without having to do them all on her own. And that's a repetitive pattern of behavior. And Liz and I both, in our very different ways, made very sure that we did not raise our kids that way. And, you know, in very differences, we were very, and I think this is common. You try and not create the same environment you were raised in. And to our dismay or not, that's how it works. And of course, we choose, you know, varied paths, and they're all different. And I don't think any of them are wrong. But I do think the important part is that we recognize where we come from. And then also we're able to go, okay, that's not the right path. we shouldn't be there? And then how do we change it or how do we correct it? And healing, you know, yourself is a big part of that. And that I think for both of us was a wake-up call to go, okay, we have priorities now. We have to fix ourselves, you know, to move forward. So Liz's telling of the, you know, the origin story, if you will, is also a reflection back on what we lost in terms of that. And then also what we knew we lost and then had to regain with our second generation, our kids.
Okay. My goodness. Right. So when you were talking about a structure that answers the questions or just keeps you from being able to ask any, what is really interesting too is the amount of inherent gaslighting that's in that, that you learn that you can't make decisions, right? Or you shouldn't. Because if left up to you, you'd make the wrong ones, right? Like, who, according to whom? And a lot of times the advice that you get in these places is so off, but you listen to it anyway. And people often will say, once I could shed myself of thinking I had to defer to the other person to tell me what to do or to the leadership or to my disciple or whomever, whatever the role was or whatever the title was, I realized their, I actually heard this last night, their advice sucked was actually the phrase, but I had to follow it. And I just thought, well, even if theirs might suck, so to speak, mine is going to be worse. Well, no, not necessarily, because yours is going to be intuitive and yours is going to be checking in with you and it's going to be reading the room and it's going to be filled with a lot of things that someone else sitting in an office or whatever who doesn't really know you is not going to be able to have insight about, but gaining the confidence to say, I get to decide something and I, not only do I get to, but I'm able, is a huge leap. I think people don't realize what a monumental leap that is and how nerve-wracking it is also, especially if you make a decision and it turned out to not be the right one, to just be able to say, whoops, and not, well, then that's it. I learned my lesson. I'm never going to make a decision again, but just really to have it be a whoops, because the most of the world outside is going to treat it that way, that it's a whoops. And often in these kinds of restrictive environments, if you make a mistake, well, then that's it. That just proves something lifelong about you. I mean, there's so much risk, you know, for making a mistake.
Rachel, you bring up exactly what Liz and I just talked about actually on our other podcast, because we're talking about the fact that even social media is a restrictive environment, particularly for younger kids. Their like buttons are their whole world. So they're encapsulated and restricted within this like button. And they're afraid to fail. And you can't be. And we just got over describing this like fear of failure. And it's in the public realm. But, you know, Liz and I, that's what, like with our phone conversations, we ultimately figured out we could fail and fall flat on our face every single time, parenting-wise, life-wise, you know, making decisions, but we had each other. And that was really, really, you know, the tie that binds for us in terms of that. And our mom still struggles with it. I didn't mean to bring this up, Liz, but I'm like, oh my God, she's talking about mom. Right? Because it's a fear of making a poor choice. And it's like, but that's also a choice.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It's also a choice. And you learn that you can deal with the consequences. And you also can learn that in the world outside, the consequences are not so severe or swift. And it's not a damnation of you and your sense of agency. I know raising my kids to be strong, to be individuals, still needing to be respectful, but being able to voice what's on their mind. You know, sometimes it's a little hard because I would say something and they'd say, or we could look at it like this. And they were kind of right. And so I would joke, I'd be like, oh, damn it. You know, like you're so, okay, let's start this again. The scene of me being a really wise parent, take two. And then I would just quote them to them. So, you know, you can try to make it funny. But Liz, what are your thoughts about this?
I definitely think my kids do have a hard time making decisions. I have fallen flat on my face a million times. My kids have seen me fall flat on my face.
I'm just going to interject for comedy, both literally and physically.
Okay. Yeah, I'm kind of a clumsy person. So yeah, literally, you're right.
In the charmingest of ways.
Okay, gotcha.
I tried to let them make decisions as they were growing up because all of our decisions were taken away from us. We didn't get to choose, you know, if we were going to do something or not. This is, we lived in such a world where it was, these are the rules, you follow them, and these are the consequences. And sometimes the consequences were more extreme than others. Sometimes they didn't follow the consequences, but the rules were always there. And then they would make up rules inside of the rules, you know? And it was just like, I lived such a structured thing. And then with my kids, I tried to let them be a little bit more of their own people and failed miserably many times because, you know, sometimes they need that structure. So finding a balance was always very challenging for me of having too many rules and not having enough with my kids, especially when they got a little bit older and were able to start making decisions on their own that weren't life altering, you know? But they've seen me do all kinds of ventures. I think the freedom of not living inside of those rules and stuff. And I also have a husband who's extremely supportive. So he, you know, I'm like, I'm going to start doing this. And he's like, okay, go for it. You know, he's always been very supportive for the most part. I'm going to say in the last 20 years of our relationship, he's been extremely supportive, probably 7 years outside of the cult, because he came into it a bit later than I did, or a lot later. I met him inside the cult, but he'd only been there for about a year. And so he was raised normal, if there's a normal, outside of a cult. You know, he wasn't raised in a cult. And so when we met and then when we left, he just was like, okay, back to normal, you know, his normal. And I was falling apart and, you know, but I have always been able to make decisions and just like go for it. And I felt a sense of freedom outside of that, but many times fallen on my face. So yeah, that's just, that has been my experience. And sometimes it's successful and sometimes it's not, but I haven't been afraid to make decisions. I think the further outside of it I get, the more freedom I feel of being my own person and taking my own risks and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's interesting. And it's interesting to hear about your husband having been someone you met there. And so I heard you talk about the chronology that he became more open and accepting because, you know, he's of course going to be impacted by the teachings within the group, which is not going to be about letting you do your thing. And so it's really nice that he was able to transform over time along with you, so that you have this ability to be able to say, I'm going to try this and I'm going to do this. Because I noticed in that example, you didn't say, is it okay with you if I, you just said, I'm going to try this. I like that. That's also big.
She's been that way our whole lives, not necessarily in the cult. And I think we have to talk about that a little bit in terms of like how, because I think IFB culture is a 10 if you take Baptist. Right, as Southern Baptist, which you mentioned at the very beginning, where like it's typically thought of as like a Southern thing, and then all of a sudden Colorado comes out of nowhere. But IFB culture, in some degree, is like proliferated throughout the U.S. in little pockets of stuff, right? Kind of like the Mormon. And if you take IFB culture, and then you kick it up 4 notches, 5 notches. That's where we were in terms of our thing. So it was very like for her husband, Liz's husband, it was a huge change. But remember that his brother at that time was kind of impacted by that. He was like, wow, you've changed your whole world around. And he like turned his life around based on this. So Liz's husband, and by the way, she got lucky. Of anyone I know that should get lucky about this, Liz deserves to be lucky with finding a good man and how willing and loving and caring he's been with her throughout this whole journey, because it's been a journey. And it's really important to me that she's taken care of. And I'm so glad that she got lucky in terms of finding this man for her, because she got married a virgin. She had a honeymoon baby. And she had 3 babies in 4 years, 4 or 5 years, 3 babies in 5 years. And it was phenomenal to watch like her go through this journey with, but he was a, her husband was there. He's been magnanimous in this whole thing because he just came in blind, not knowing what was going on. And that restrictive culture and then allowing her that freedom is really, really like, as a sister, it makes me just go, oh my God, I'm so glad that she has him, you know, and we're there for each other. But also he was ridiculously supportive and still has been, you know, in this whole thing.
It's really nice. And it's lovely for you, Rachel, as a sister, to be clearly so supportive and happy for, you know, your sister. It's interesting because one of the things that I talk about is that sometimes when people have been in groups like this, their relationships with each other have been weaponized. And I don't hear a lot of that. I'm happy for you. And so that is very meaningful. And I want to be able to come back to that. I do want to go into your history, though, just like a day in the life or a year in the life. Like, what was your life like there? If you're saying this kicked it up a notch so many times, can only imagine. So paint us a picture.
Okay. So obviously, both of us were there from birth, basically. I mean, earliest memories. We're there inside the, we'll say cult. I have no problem using that because by every definition of that, it was a cult. Every definition. So there's a lot of, oh, it's, you know, purgatorial in terms of like what it is. And I'm like, no, it's not. It clearly, definitively was a cult. So I have no problem using that word and I will defend it and I don't mind that. So our earliest memories, everything we knew was surrounded by a, we'll say a community. And in honesty, I think Liz will agree with me on this. In all honesty, we had an idyllic childhood. We had a diverse and a very welcoming and wide range of family in terms of how we were raised. We had lots of parental figures, even though my mom was a single mother. And we had, you know, multiple siblings who were friends. We had multiple people on which we were raised in. So if you want to say it takes a village, that's what we were raised in from our primary, right? So if we talk about child development, primary was actually quite developmentally stimulating. It was good for us. We actually, Liz and I are avid readers. We didn't have television, secular books. We didn't have radio. So we were very much sheltered in this little bubble that we lived in. When her and I went to school, it was not at a public school. It was at a church school. So most of our days looked like we would wake up very early in the morning. We would go to the church and or school, right? In our primary years, I'm specifically referring to those. And we would have all day with our schoolmates and our classmates. And most of that was surrounded by the exact same people that we knew from church. On Sundays all day, we were at church. On Mondays, we were at school all day. On Tuesdays, we were at school all day. On Wednesdays, we would go to school and then we would have church in the evenings. On Thursdays, we would go to school all day. We would have proselytizing in the evenings. On Fridays, we would go to school all day. On Saturdays, we would get up early and go to do bus routes or further proselytization within the community. And that would last most of the day, including outreach to marginalized communities, including homeless, you know, mentally impaired, those kind of things. And that would happen all day. So then we would repeat that process every day. Our whole entire world revolved around this community that in all of our best knowledge of that community was to help people. And that was a big, huge part of it, is that you're here for a higher purpose. You're going to be in service of the community around you, and the community around you is servicing you, and they are taking care of you. They are educating you. They are feeding you. They are, right? My mom, for many years, was a school teacher. She was not a certified school teacher, nor was she qualified. But all of our investments in this world went to that investment. My mother was single mom. She did not have any child support. She did not have any other outlets. Her community was the church. And she was also vulnerable. And I can't overstress that point, is that it was a vulnerable position in her life and she was preyed upon. Absolutely. And she did what she thought was best for us. And that's okay. So as, and Liz and I have talked about this ad nauseum in the book, it progressively got more. I don't think anyone joins a group in a community like that that's as welcoming without it progressing to a different point. And it did. So over our lifetime, between the time Liz and I went into grade school, primary school, quote unquote school, to the time that I was in middle school is where it took a huge dark shift and started getting more repressive, more rules. The guidelines here, you know, you need to be dressed this certain way and you need to act this certain way. And then the line got moved. And it kept getting moved and it kept getting moved and it got more and more restrictive, more and more controlling, more and more of your individual thoughts and ideas were completely quashed in terms of this overbearing purpose. And I think that's pretty common among, you know, cult behaviors, and that definitely we saw that. So, you know, it did reach a point at which, yeah, her and I both were, there was a breaking point.
Right. Okay. And so, yeah, we certainly want to talk about the breaking point. When you said also that she was preyed upon, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So, again, my mother, as Liz already spoke about, was a Marine. It was very uncommon in, you know, that era for a woman to join the Marines. My mother had a pretty abusive childhood, in my opinion, and is not really want to talk about that. And that's okay. I understand it. It's sort of a generational thing. And there are some things that she's not happy to deal with. That's okay. We understand that. And, you know, that's okay in her own time. She was escaping something that she didn't want to be in. She met my father, who was not a father. He was just a sperm donor, as we lovingly refer to him. The story of which his death is also a long one. She was in need of someone or something to save her. She had three young children. She was a single mother with absolutely no life skills to which she could rely on to support and or provide for her children and her family. And someone knocking at her door, inviting the community in which she so craved, was exactly what she needed, and also what they, and I say they in terms of the cult, were looking for. In terms of loyalty, you're never going to get someone who's more loyal or more forgiving of wrongdoings when you meet a mother who's trying to provide for her kids and do the best by them, and then also going, well, we're going to do this now. And are you okay with this? Well, yeah, well, you've provided for me and my children, including, you know, at times food. We Liz and I dumpster dived when we were kids. We were so poor that we had to at times. This is a vulnerable population. And I'm not talking about in terms of race or anything other than socioeconomic class. She had no skills. She had no job. She had nothing. And outside of being on the welfare system, which at that time, Reaganomics was, right, in terms of Republican and right-wing culture, absolutely not okay. So she avoided food stamps, you know, in a way to say, oh, I'm better than that, but I'm not going to choose to feed my children. And who else do I have to rely on? Oh, the church, right? The cult. So therefore, food to mouth, feeding your children, all came from the church. So sustenance, the life. Giving her kids life, giving her kids food, shelter, housing, all came from the church. So it put her into a square peg, into the hole where she had to rely on that because her belief system was so intertwined and loyal to this cult that she had no other option than to just continue to double down on that and continue to rely on that cult to survive her.
When you say prey, prey on them, I felt like they did have a target. They did, this particular brand of cult went towards military, single moms. They preyed, it's a good word, but they preyed on those types of people because in a military, you're used to being told what to do, when to do it, how to do it. And so they pulled those types of people in. And then single moms, because they were loyal, because they would provide something that they couldn't. And so there was a lot of there was a huge single mothers group in the cult. There was also, you know, military was huge. I think probably at one time, half of the church was military. You know, there was a lot of that type of people that they preyed on because they were looking for people to follow their rules and to follow the system.
And just like every other cult, it progresses over time. It gets more restrictive, you know, particularly in our case where there were some major, major issues with how it was structured. That as their risk gets higher, that they tighten the rules.
Wow. Okay. And I'm wondering then also, you know, Liz, if there are more stories. I mean, it's very, very moving when you say, Rachel, that you went dumpster diving. What a difficult life. Just having food insecurities, very hard for anyone. What else do you remember, Liz, that really paints a picture of your life?
I just know that we were so mentally immature. I think that was a massive thing for me. When I got married, I had no clue. There's no sex education, except, you know, both of us were obviously abused in that situation. My sister much younger than I was. But when you tell someone that you were sexually abused at 16, they're like, well, 16-year-old, you know what's going on. Nope, you don't. In that type of environment where everything is so restricted and so, you know, you go by these rules and you follow this and these leaders are like God and, you know, you do everything they say. And then when one of them breaks your trust and, you know, abuses you sexually, emotionally, all of the things, you just go with it. And then you have no idea. I mean, I thought for years that I had done something wrong when I was 16, you know, because that's how I was made to feel and that's how I felt. And, you know, didn't even deal with it until several years ago because it's something that I thought that was my fault. But they make you feel so guilty. I think that I live with guilt now. Continuously, I have a major guilt factor. I have a guilt factor with my kids. You know, anything they bring up that happened when they were growing up or something and, you know, that I did wrong, it's like something that's like painfully, but they drilled in us this guilt that we had to follow these things. And if you did anything outside of that, the guilt was just something that was ingrained in us. And so I feel that I really had a hard time overcoming that because they just, I mean, when you're drilled it for 20 years, it's hard to get that out of your system.
Well, it's not even just 20 years. It's your whole life.
Yeah.
Up until that point. Yeah,
for sure. Yeah.
So, you know, Liz, you were telling a story and I want to make sure to, you know, to honor some of these experiences that I know are not easy to talk about, but they really help the people listening understand what was so difficult, what also was part of the crux of what you needed to heal from after leaving. So what else would you like us to know about what you went through?
In terms of the sexual abuse, I will say that, you know, from the pulpit, from school, from everywhere, there's these leaders screaming at you about how you need to keep yourself pure and how you need to not touch a boy. I mean, we couldn't have a phone conversation with a boy, couldn't go on a date. You couldn't do any of these things. And then you have a leader that puts you in these vulnerable positions. And there's absolutely the word grooming applies here because, you know, we didn't have a dad. So there was this guy that was, you know, making me feel like I could trust him, like I could rely on him, like he was there to help me, and then do all of these nice, kind gestures and, you know, just different things that he would say, compliments and things like that. And then eventually start the abuse. And I had no idea how to handle it. I literally thought, also, I'm the only one this is happening to, you know, at the time. And so I can't say a word. And he said, you can't tell my wife this is going on. And because, you know, he made me feel like I caused this to happen. And so, you know, I'm living with this. I lived with it for over 20 years before I started dealing with it, because I still felt guilt over it. So that is one of the hardest things that I have ever had to get over. I think, like Rachel and I talked about earlier, writing the book and writing all of it down, and actually wrote out the whole experience. I wrote out everything, and it was so therapeutic for me just to put it on paper. I've kept a journal. My sister is a very large component of therapy. I had some extremely messed up situations in the cult with therapy, which they call it counseling with the leader. And so for me, that was off the table for years, because he, the leader that I was giving me counseling, was so inappropriate and so made me so uncomfortable. And it was not a good place for me to be. So I had a lot of issues trusting somebody to be a counselor or a therapist or anything like that, because of how many years of counseling I had inside the cult that were so negative and so bad. And, you know, I would leave in tears and just thinking there was something wrong with me. And it was never a good experience, but you were not allowed to see a secular psychiatrist or a, you know, counselor or anything like that. The leaders were your counselors and those were who you talked to, but you couldn't tell them anything without being judged or being screamed at from the pulpit. They would lay everything out there, what you told them. So there was no trust. And so I think that that has been tough for me to just trust a therapist. I've tried to do it a couple times. I find that journaling has been one of the best things. And also my sister and my husband are also my people. So, you know, talking to them and, you know, getting it out there like that has been very helpful for me. So that's how I've that's pretty much how I've overcome it. I have not overcome all of it, but I have been able to function, I feel like, in a way that is productive and that I can, it's not in my mind 24/7.
Okay. I'm really glad to hear that. And I think if you don't mind taking a few moments and talking about the therapy, when you're saying that it was making you really uncomfortable, a lot of people have said that too, that they're really nervous about coming to therapy with me because of their experiences in their church or whatever they were in. And also with group therapy, people are nervous because they've been called on the carpet in front of a group. That was a kind of set up for shaming. And so there are people also said that I've met with a counselor who just told me how I was the cause of my abuse. And they also asked for lots of details. And I felt like they were kind of getting turned on by the things I was saying. Like, it just felt wrong on so many levels. I'm wondering what felt wrong to you about this.
So I would go to ask for advice, or especially during my abuse, I went in a lot because I thought that I was doing something wrong and I needed to find out what was wrong with me that I would cause this man to do this to me. And I never said the words because I couldn't, I couldn't tell him what was going on because it was a horrible sin. So I couldn't tell him what was going on, but I would go and talk to him and just tell him what's going on in my head outside of the abuse, but that I was feeling like I didn't belong there anymore. It was like, I was uncomfortable being even in the church. That was when I started to question being in the cult, in the religion, in anything like that. And I started questioning. So then I would bring it up, and then that I was questioning whether God would think that these types of things, such as the way certain situations were handled, or he would preach people out of the church, which when I say preach people out of the church, he would get up at the pulpit. This is the main leader with an agenda that these people did wrong. And he was going to say whatever he wanted to say to make them leave the church. And his goal was to get them to walk out in the middle of the sermon. So I would bring things like that up to him. And I'm saying, well, if somebody is sinning, don't you think God would want them to stay and get help? Why would you want to preach them out of the pulpit? And I would immediately get shut down that I don't know what I'm talking about. I am not a man of God, things like that. So any kind of questioning was never allowed. And when I did question, I remember asking him one time, this is how naive I was, how I would know if I was a virgin, because you were not supposed to get married until you're a virgin. And I got asked questions like, do you masturbate? Like super uncomfortable questions like this from somebody who is, in my opinion, a man of God. And it would freak me out. And he would go into specifics of these things, of what I did. And at this time, you know, I was just like so embarrassed. I didn't even know what the word meant. There was just so many uncomfortable conversations like that, that made me think that I could not trust him any longer. And I eventually quit going. And then, you know, going outside of that, I don't even know how you start has been my thought. How do you even start talking to somebody about your experiences that doesn't understand? Because I feel like if you don't grow up in that situation, it's very hard to explain.
It really is. And there are people who will come to see me who will say, I already met with a number of therapists where I felt like they just didn't understand, or they weren't open to learning more about it, or they just kept changing the subject and because that's not what they learned in school. So I do, you know, I'm always kind of doing a plug for people out there who are becoming counselors, who are becoming therapists, social workers, to really learn about this. But thank you for letting me know about what that was like and the fact that you couldn't talk about it because it was a sin. Oh my goodness, right? And that you're the one carrying around the shame and the guilt, which happens almost all the time, even though you didn't do that to someone, someone did it to you, but still, that's how it works. And I'm so sorry. So anything else before we talk about kind of the breaking point for both of you? Any other story you want to make sure to mention?
I think Rachel's story of her abuse kind of leads to the breaking point. So that might be good for her to share a little bit of. I know that her experience was the cause of the breaking point of when we left.
All right. So then do you feel comfortable getting into that, Rachel, for a bit?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. As opposed to Liz, I had a very different version of therapy, and I'm always a fan. I'm always, you know, not pushing people, but also suggesting that it's actually, you know, a third party that is outside of Liz's experience with it is actually supposed to be trauma-informed and a therapist who understands and knows what you're doing. But I won't disagree with her in the fact that there are very few and far between. And I will say that I have been in and out of therapy for since I left the cult. So that's been over 25 years. And I rely on it, and I actually have a lot of faith in it. And Liz is not wrong. You can have family, you can have friends, and you can have, you know, other tools also available to you. And I think that those are fine. And I think that writing the book with Liz was a huge therapeutic process for her. And I absolutely supported that 100%. We had about probably a 4 to 6 month hiatus after writing that book, in which neither of us could really talk about it or look at it again. That is intentional, and that was intentional, and it took some time. And I think that writing is a form of therapy. So with that said, and I understand and know most of Liz's history about therapy, if we talk about my experience and leading up to the breaking point for when we left the cult, in 1999, my abuser was tried, convicted, and sentenced to 12 years in prison for sexually assaulting a minor. And that was with multiple accounts. He took a plea deal, which I was not actually comfortable taking. But at the time, I didn't have a voice for myself and I couldn't speak up about that. And had I brothers, I would have been in the courtroom and I would have faced him personally and been able to do that. I was not strong enough at the time, nor could I have probably done that. However, in hindsight, I stood up for what I was abused for and assaulted for. And I took the power in that situation. And that was quite beneficial to my mental health moving forward from that experience. I was sexually abused from 12 to about 14 multiple times, and from a man who was the pastor's son, choir director at the cult, and also groomed me for multiple years prior to that. I ended it. I didn't feel right. I didn't know exactly why, but I wasn't sure that this was correct. But there's an extreme hypocrisy in cult religions about being untouched virginity, and that is a value upon which you don't, you're not allowed to tread in terms of what you're supposed to do comportment wise as a female. And everything that I experienced was exactly the antithesis of that, meaning that was taken away from me at a very early age. And so those conflicting terms and conflicting ideologies in my mind weighed on me heavily for a long time. I had a long period of insomnia, anxiety, still do, with that cognitive dissonance. That was an ideology of which I was trained to believe in, and then also got handed the opposite hand of that. I didn't speak out about that. I sort of let it happen and then went along with the program for many, many years. I also was not a child who was actually a good rule follower. I was always outside of the box, and I always made sure that that was apparent. And my mouth has always been my weapon of choice. And it was never allowed to be fully extended. And I do think that there were special circumstances surrounding my particular abuse in which it was made to be more suppressive and or more oppressive in terms of that. And I think that that is something that made me actually more vocal when and if it came to be able to speak about it. I dealt with this pain and this abuse and this massive repression of who I was and what I wanted to say and where I thought things were. And this, it is a cognitive dissonance, living a life in which you know everything is wrong about it, and then also getting feedback from the every person or entity in your life that is supposed to be the authority on this and understanding that they're absolutely wrong. So I dealt with that for many, many years. So by the time, so 12 was the initial abuse. And then when I was 19, I had the opportunity, again, probably very calculated from the cult, to go and attend a parochial college in Hammond, Indiana, which is no surprise to anyone. And after returning from that foray into what is a different cult look like, I came home and knew exactly to Colorado and knew exactly what I had to do. And I had to leave. I had to get away from everything that I knew was oppressive and I knew was wrong. But now I had some traction. I had a little bit of a glimmer of hope in which to see that there was something else out there. And that I knew that this was potentially wrong. And I didn't know how or why, but I did knew. I knew in my gut that I had to get out. And I knew that that came along with some repercussions. And I knew that a lot of those were going to probably be losing my family, losing my friends, losing that community that I grew up in an idyllic childhood. And I knew that that was something that I would have to give up. And I had to get to the point at which I could allow that to happen. And I was slowly doing that as I got back. So it was 1998. And I was slowly getting back to that idea that, okay, if I do it gradually, if I don't show up for church on Sunday morning, if I don't show up to this event. If I slowly, gradually get myself out, I can kind of piecemeal the loss, the grief of losing all of that at some point. And then I had a breaking point. And that breaking point came when I saw the pattern of abuse. I'm going to let you take over in a minute, Liz, as far as the breaking point. I was slowly doing that gradual march to let's let this go. And how am I going to deal with that? So emotionally, physically, I had already kind of started that direction. And then my sister had her first child, and that happened before I got back. So I wasn't there for the birth, but of course this child was everything, and it was a girl, and it was amazing. And it, you know, there's no better, you know, aside from having your own children, when your sister has a child, it was monumental. And I was just so overwhelmed with the, you know, the emotions of joy and love and all the things that come with having a new baby inside the family that was my sister's. And it's almost like having your own, but it's not quite, and it's even better. So I'm so overwhelmed with all these emotions and just the outpouring of love. At that point, I was almost out. I was like, I could taste the door. It's right there, you know, but my sister was still in it with her husband, with the new baby, with my mom. And I couldn't bring myself yet to tell them that I was gone and that I was going. And now this new life brings form to something I can't really express, but all of a sudden there it is right in front of my face. Liz, you can take it from there.
Yeah. So that was, she had been missing stuff. I noticed, we talked about it. She was wearing pants. So I had found out she was wearing pants, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, in a strange turn of events. Anyway, we went to an event. It was actually, I believe, a wedding of somebody out in Black Forest. Anyway, everybody from the church was there. And I had my daughter, who's about 6 months old. And we were there together, me, my husband, my daughter. Rachel was there. And we went to this event, and her abuser, which I had no idea at the time, came over and picked up my daughter. And Rachel was way across the room and made it there in about 1 second flat, grabs her and says, "Don't you ever let him touch her again." And I was just like, oh my gosh, what happened? You know, I had no idea. I had no idea she had been abused. I had no idea any of this. So I just said, okay. And it kind of was an abrupt thing. We ended up leaving. The next night she calls me and said, she's at work at the mall. And she calls me and she said, "You have to come here right now. I have to talk to you. It's an emergency." So I went up there. She spilled everything, told me everything, all about her abuse. That was it. Like, because in my mind, my sister was the most important thing in the world. And the fact that she had been abused and had held this in for so long and told me everything, I was like, "We have to go to the police. We have to do this. We have to do this." She said, "Don't tell mom." Of course, I told mom. And my mom got her to go to the police. You know, the rest is history. Of course, there was a whole thing of, "Let's go talk to the pastors about this and let's go talk to them." And they knew, they all knew. It didn't matter. We left. It was very abrupt, but we all left. My mom followed us, which is amazing. The fact
rare and appreciated. And
yes.
Yeah.
She believed her. She believed my sister.
Well, mom went to the police.
Yeah.
I mean, mom and I went to the police and told my story only under threat of subpoena. But she made me do it. And, you know, that was a time mom stood up for us. She didn't when we were growing up. But she got the opportunity, she saw the wrongdoing, and she did the right thing. And that's really, really like powerful in terms of women and mom and raising kids and family and all of that. Because when she got handed the opportunity to do the right thing, you know, she did. And that's basically what led to Yeah, we had a criminal. We had a criminal suit. He did go to prison. He actually lives near Liz right now in Oklahoma. So, you know, I'd be happy to start a campaign against him. But anyway,
yes.
But yeah, again, scot-free now. Probably grooming and doing God knows what to other women. But you know, that's our system. He did go to prison. He did. We subsequently sued the organization, the church, basically their insurance company, and I got a civil lawsuit. It's a long story, but 25 years ago, you know, 99 is when this all went down. And it took us that long, though, to figure out, oh, God, we actually have a priority now. We have kids. We're not going to let our kids grow up in a cult. We're not going to let them grow up under a oppressed environment of where their ideas don't matter and where their female voices don't matter. They are going to be loud and heard no matter what, even if it's to our detriment. And Liz, every morning, she's like, oh, God, you know, the girls have done this bullshit. And I'm like, that's fine. They're allowed to say their voice. They're allowed to speak. They're allowed to be the imbeciles that they are at this young age. And that's okay. The freedom that we've been able to give our kids because we took that into our, there's a lot of, I would say, like hoopla right now about the IFB, and there's been some documentaries and stuff. And I was like, oh, okay, well, we should get on that. And then Liz and I both are like, no, we're over it. Partly being because we've been out of it 25 years. We have a bit more clarity. We have a bit more of like insight as to what the journey looks like for someone coming out of this. And it's harrowing. It's hard. It's arduous. It's something that unless you have, you know, the gumption and the wherewithal to figure out and then critically think for yourself, which is something that is not taught. And we had to learn on our own. You know, I went through education system publicly and Liz went through her own version of it also, but we both have degrees. We're both in the real world doing our thing right now, but it was not without scars.
That's incredible. I know we're unfortunately done with time, but I'm hoping that you both can come back so we can continue because I want to hear so much more about this moment and the transition out and the challenges of that. And even though some things are going to feel so clear and like, yes, there are going to be these other moments of great trepidation, real worry, and a lot of trial and error. You know, it's interesting that, I mean, it's beautiful that the two of you have each other and the fact that Liz, you could call Rachel and say like, my girls just did this. You know, I feel like there are these themes that can be applied to, especially when kids are preteen and teen, that I think their life can be under two headings, which is, I thought it was a good idea at the time, right? And that sounded better in my head. Okay. So, right? And so I think they're learning while you're learning, right? And parents are learning as they go, but also people who just were not raised in this way.
In every sense of that term, Rachel, we grew up together with our kids. Absolutely. Because like Liz iterated to earlier, she was abused at 16. She was not a 16-year-old at 16 because of the suppression of the cult. She was probably closer to 12, 13 developmentally. And then when we had kids and Liz had her first kid at 19, We raised our kids with us. We were growing. We were learning about the real world as they were learning it.
And that's a really nice thing. I mean, that takes a lot of really beautiful honesty and humility to be able to say that and to acknowledge that. And that you don't have to be the I know best parent, right? You know, kids need to know that their parents know some things beyond what they know, but you don't have to always know everything. And your process of learning is actually a great model for them to see that it is true that we are all kind of transitioning into being more able, having more wisdom as we go. So, yeah. So let's make sure to find another time to continue this conversation. And then also want to hear more about the book that you put together. So let's get that on the calendar. I am so happy to at least have started the conversation with both of you. And it's beautiful to see your relationship with each other and how strengthening it's been and how much wisdom you share with our listeners. It's really very powerful. And your honesty, it's also really beautiful. Thank you so much for our conversation today.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
One more thing before you go. Wow. Thank you to Rachel and to Elizabeth. It is so good to see these sisters really leaning on each other, really helping each other out, having each other's backs. So often it happens that when people have gone through something like this, they get very, very, very close. But I've also seen where sometimes people who have gone through things like this distance themselves from each other because the other reminds them of that time. I'm so glad that they have found a way to not only remain close, but to work together and to also do something really important, which is to support each other in coming forward. It can happen within sibling groups or a couple where there's more than one person in any kind of dyad, where there's one who wants to talk and the other one doesn't, and then they kind of feel alone. And it sounds like it's important for both of them, to varying degrees, probably, as each human being is different, to be able to talk about what happened, but still make sure that their information gets out there. I think that their story is so empowering because I hear from a lot of people that they want to be able to come forward. They want to be able to say what their pastor, let's say, did to them, but they are afraid. They're afraid because their families are still involved in that particular group and they don't want to make life harder for their families, or they're afraid of how they're going to get attacked if they come forward with their story, or how much they're going to be defamed if they come forward with their story, and to what degree they'll be believed or not believed. And it is a very cruel thing that happens to a lot of people where they finally come forward and then are just not believed. It happens to a lot of people who are bringing sexual abuse charges against someone, especially someone who is high profile. Women or men are so defamed and are really skewered, are really made to feel like they are regretting coming forward. So knowing that Rachel and Elizabeth were able to come forward and be empowered throughout and push against the naysayers, I'm sure, and the criticisms and critics, and to still push things forward to the point where there was the arrest and criminal conviction of the son of the pastor who had been involved in serial pedophilia for decades. What's also, though, important when you come forward is knowing that then a lot of people who were afraid of coming forward because they didn't want to be the first one or the first ones now feel emboldened, empowered, safer to come forward. And so it takes a lot to be the first. It takes a lot to put yourself out there. And it's also important to know, though, that when you do this, you are opening the door for other people to be able to feel brave enough to say, this happened to me too.
There's something incredibly isolating about being a whistleblower. And there's also something incredibly isolating, like Liz was talking about being sexually abused by the leader of the church that you're in, then being told to keep it a secret, and then feeling or believing that you are the only one there who is being abused. You can be in a large group of people all around you and feel alone. And so what helps kind of set the ball in motion when you really want to be able to move things forward and get justice is that you need to sometimes rely on someone else's strength to feel buoyed, to feel safe enough to move forward, just as Rachel and Elizabeth have given to each other. Their life has been a hard one. As they talk about having gone dumpster diving when they were young, they were raised without. They were raised without so many things. They were raised without creature comforts. But they were raised without safety. And so as you become an adult in the world, it becomes very important to ensure that you are safe. I think it's great that Rachel does work that helps people get a sense of their own bodies and being strong in their bodies, being capable in their bodies. And it has infused her work, and I'm sure she does a lot, to empower people and make them feel confident. And the fact that Elizabeth has all these businesses and is running around being very effective and successful and really knowing that her life has been able to be so much better since leaving, it is such a good thing to be able to experience that finally in your life. But I do think that as people hear these kinds of stories, they still might wonder about coming forward. And I want to say that even though that gets commended on this show, it's not for everyone. And I don't want you to feel like you have to tell your story if you don't feel ready or if it really isn't safe for you to do so. You can still enjoy the fact that other people are speaking the words that you wish you could speak, and also that they've had experiences like yours, so you are not alone. Thank you again to Rachel and to Elizabeth. Take good care. Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.